Americans rely on the Food and Drug Administration to ensure their food is monitored and safe. But is safety upheld over profits, and should the FDA or the manufacturer be monitoring and testing? Stand by. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. And welcome to Go Healthy for Good. As pesticide residues, genetic engineering and pollution threaten the safety of our foods, more of us are turning to organic. And that's encouraging more farmers to go organic too, like Mike Snow from Willowsford Conservancy and Farm in Virginia. Watch.
I was inspired to start farming when I was in college. I got really interested first in history and then in geography. Learning a lot about all of sort of the social and environmental issues. I went to school in a rural state and started working on farms as a geographer and a mapper. While I was doing that, I really enjoyed the quality of life of the work, and I like being outside. I like getting my hands dirty and doing something and making something. I think most important was I was working for a farmer, and he made lunch for us, and the quality of the food was much different than something I'd experienced before, and I hadn't really thought about food much in the before that. I like food, and you know, I was adventurous enough with food, but I never really sort of ate real vegetables that had just been picked and nothing that was sort of still living. As organic farmers, we look at nature and how it takes care of, manages pests and manages fertility. And you know, if you go out to a place that is wild, it doesn't need any inputs. We try to look at how can we provide the proper nutrition for plants and the soil health for plants in a way that doesn't require chemicals or doesn't require synthetic pesticides or anything like that. And so we do that by mimicking the way nature does that. We provide habitat for insects to provide our pest control. We grow plants, cover crops, or other soil nourishing crops to improve the soil, and then the plants get what they need from that. So it's a much more challenging way of farming, and I think it sort of meets my need for intellectual stimulation and learning as I go, rather than just having a prescription and, you know, starting the season and being told that I need to use this product, and I use this product at this day and this product that day.
Sounds like a production line rather than a farm. On today's show, we'll find out how to limit chemical exposure, work up a sweat with Sean, and talk to a nutritionist about food safety. But first, the news. In the headlines today, marketing and labelling, dietary triggers for severe pancreatitis, and toxic packaging. Pasture-raised milk is gaining popularity in Europe and the US, but can labelling recoup the added cost? Recently, researchers from the University of Gothenburg, Germany, set out to answer that question by seeing how much extra German consumers were willing to pay for niche market milk. To reduce costs, the pasture-raised milk could be mixed with conventional milk and classically labelled at least 50% pasture-raised milk. Alternatively, it could carry a cause-related label stating, supporting farmers who keep their cows on pasture. The average consumer was willing to pay 54 cents more for pasture-raised milk certified with the classical label, and only 40 cents more for pasture-raised milk with cause-related labelling. Marketing research like this is the norm for all foodstuffs, and the result influences labelling trends. A diet lacking in fruits, veggies, and adequate fluid intake has been linked to severe acute pancreatitis. A preliminary study of over 300 patients has found that 81% of people who had severe pancreatitis consumed less than 3 portions of fresh fruit and veggies a day, compared with only 58% of patients with mild pancreatitis. Also, those with severe disease drank around 6 cups of fluid a day, compared with 7.5 for those with mild disease. When fluid intake was linked to body weight, there was an almost 25% difference. Authors of the study point out that mild pancreatitis usually needs 2 or 3 days in hospital, whereas severe disease means a month in hospital, during which time 1 in 4 people die. By the way, there were 5 vegetarians in the study, not enough to prove the benefit, but none of them had severe disease. So eat your fruit and veggies, drink plenty of water, and your pancreas will thank you. Now, it's not just fast food that's unhealthy. Its packaging may contain fluorine that can leach into that food. Of 407 fast food packaging samples tested in a recent study, 33% had detectable levels of fluorine, a marker for a class of chemicals called PFAs. Previous research has linked PFAs to cancer, thyroid disease, immune toxicity, lower birth weight, and reduced fertility. The reason they're used in food packaging is because of their water and grease-resistant properties. Nearly half the paper and 20% of cardboard food containers in the study tested positive for fluorine. Those products were collected from 27 large fast food chains in 5 regions of the US, including 2 that were sure their packaging did not contain PFAs. Yet they did, which makes it hard to avoid them unless you eat more fresh foods and avoid takeout food that comes in grease-proof packaging. I'm Dr. Narada McKibben, and that's today's health news. Kelly Dorfman is a nutritionist with a busy clinical practice. She prescribes nutrition as medicine and takes a keen interest in food safety. I asked her about the regulations that the FDA uses to monitor ingredients in our food.
It was set up in the 50s. There's a program called Generally Regarded as Safe, and this is a program where you can submit as a company your ingredient that you're thinking about using, and then it can be determined through a bunch of regulations and paperwork whether it's generally considered to be safe. But most ingredients are not tested this way. Most ingredients are just presumed by the companies to be safe, and through some loophole, they're just put out anyway. I mean, there just was a recent study I read where 236 ingredients they found that had really had no research whatsoever on them, and they were just company suggested. There was, for example, you probably heard that there is a sports drink that a lot of kids drink that had an ingredient that had been on the list for 20 years, and there had never been any safety data. And it was put on the list with the presumption that the company would go back and do some safety. And I don't want to mention any names, but you probably would know this, the name of this sports drink. And they never did. And so they eventually just took it out.
So they took the product out.
They took ingredient out.
That ingredient,
yes.
I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody still knows whether it was safe, whether it wasn't.
Well, there were some pretty good suggestions that it wasn't very safe. There were a lot of complaints about it. And the company kept saying, well, we'll do some research on it. We'll get around to it. And the years kept rolling by, and they just didn't. And then they finally just took it out.
So I was on the FDA website, and I read, food packaging manufacturers must prove to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration that all materials coming in contact with food are safe before they are permitted for use in such a manner. So who is monitoring this, and is the onus on the FDA? Is the onus back on the food manufacturer to provide this? And is there a time limit set to when they will do that?
It is pretty much a free-for-all system that depends on the companies behaving themselves and providing this data. They don't have the wherewithal or the resources to do this kind of testing with the tens of thousands of potential ingredients that come out. So it really is up to the food company. So ultimately, it's really up to us, the consumers, to beware. And that's why it's important when you read a label that you recognize the ingredients, because you really have no absolute safety criteria that has been a tested ingredient, that we have research on it, that we know is something that's going to be safe.
Are there any watchdog organizations that could help us, or is the onus really on us, and where do we go for that to
find
that?
We need both, really. There are watchdog organizations. There's Center for Science and the Public Interest. There's a lot of mothers' advocacy groups that are watching out for us. There's a lot of bloggers that write things. Remember the whole thing about Subway and the yoga mat ingredients, that was from a blogger. So there are a lot of organizations that are helping the FDA and bringing to the attention of them certain ingredients that need to be watched.
Watched by us all. Now it's time to think about this.
What are you doing?
Oh, I'm mulching these vegetables. They're organic, you know.
Oh, that's a really good idea because all the vegetables in the market are full of pesticides, aren't they?
So is that fish you're eating.
What?
Yeah.
No way. We all know that the biggest concern with pesticides is with vegetables and fruits, not with fish.
Oh, really? You've never heard of biomagnification?
Biomagnificent?
Biomagnification. You know, the big fish eat lots of little fish, which eat tons of phytoplankton plants living in pesticide-contaminated waters. And so as you go up the food chain, the concentration of pesticide gets magnified up to 10,000 times.
Oh, and I'm eating it?
Uh-huh. Happens with most meat.
Oh, no. So this is a chemical warehouse?
That's right.
So I should have ordered that phytoplankton burger instead.
Go vegetarian. Reduce your pesticides, herbicides, toxic chemicals, and your heavy metals. Doctor's orders.
If we have concerns about what food manufacturers do to our food, we should also think about the way we cook and store our own meals. So let's start with cooking. Often we'll microwave, and surprisingly, microwaving food retains the most nutrients. But be sure to use ceramic or glass containers with a paper cover, and I'll explain why in a minute. The stove is where most of us cook, and there we have a number of options. The most popular and convenient are the range of non-stick cookware. And so we have things like the typical Teflon, and we have ceramic. Now, if I talk about the Teflon, this non-stick surface is a synthetic polymer called polytetrafluoroethylene, or PTFE, also known as Teflon. As it wears off and flakes into our food, it's actually not a problem, apparently, because it's inert in that form. It's when it encounters high heat that toxic fumes are released, which can kill a bird in seconds, so keep your budgie out of the kitchen if you're cooking with Teflon. In people, it causes a flu-like illness called polymer fume fever. And while we don't know about Teflon specifically, perfluorinated chemicals, or PFCs in general, cause lower birth weight, smaller size of newborns, increased cholesterol, abnormal thyroid levels, inflammation of the liver, and suppression of the immune system. So it might be wise to switch to something else. You can switch to ceramic, which can't really tolerate as much heat, but and it does stick a little bit, or you can just go simply to stainless steel, which is an inert, and you can fry foods pretty well in stainless steel. Besides, we don't want to eat too many fried foods anyway, since it removes the nutrients and adds carcinogens like acrylamide. You can go to the traditional cast iron pan. It can handle the heat, though you don't want to get too much iron into your food, since an excess iron has been implicated with Alzheimer's. So an enamel coating like this is a good solution to that problem. Avoiding aluminum because of its link to Alzheimer's is probably wise. Some studies say yes, some studies say no. I just don't use it if I can avoid it. For baking, oven-safe glass is the best option. Now it's time to talk about plastics and why we don't want to cook with them or put the, you know, in the microwave or store hot food or even maybe store food on the shelves in them. Most plastics will come with a recycle code on the bottom. The safer ones are the 1, the 2, the 4, and the 5. This is a 1. This is made of polyethylene terephthalates. So these two are number 1s. These are your typical containers. Number 2 is like this medicine bottle, high-density polyethylene. Or it might say PE in the little circle. Number 4 is a low-density polyethylene, and that would be like the lid of these types of containers. And number 5, we see a lot of number 5s in our kitchen and amongst the containers. That's polypropylene, or a little PP within your circle. More concern are number 3s, which contain PVC, phthalates, or their substitutes. Number 6, which is polystyrene or styrene. And number seven, polycarbonates, which are usually hard and clear, and they contain BPA or their substitutes, and it's hard to find a number seven anymore. But these are all examples of number six. So these dishes that you would eat out of, drink out of, even drink cold drinks with. So all of these, this is a takeaway container that, or takeout container that's a number five on the bottom, but the lid is a number six. So these are all things that you might have used in the last wee while that are actually in that concern list. Now, if you're wondering about pesticides, there's Pesticide Action Network that's really helpful. If you want to know about mercury in fish, go to the FDA website. And then for a great free educational app, try Detox Me. It's produced by the Silent Spring Institute, which has spent 20 years researching the effects of environmental toxicants on human health. And Detox Me lets you scan product barcodes for information on items in the store. It helps you eliminate chemicals from every sector of your life, and it's all divided up there on the screen. And because chemicals pretty much are untested, and so this gives you a way of knowing how to just eliminate them. And then it gives you helpful tips on how to replace those things with non-chemical alternatives. So how do you clean? How do you kill weeds? And all of those things. So I hope you find that helpful. Mike Snow first got farm exposure as a geographer and mapper. Then he experienced the freshest veggies he had ever eaten, direct from the garden. And here's what happened to his career. Check it out.
I don't know how I heard about it, but I found myself at a permaculture design course on an island in Washington State. A family, brothers, had started this farm maybe 30 years before, and they had a very well-developed farm. And they used permaculture as a design method, a way of thinking about how they were going to put all of the parts of their farm together so that each of those parts made the other parts better. And so basically they made their own like ecosystem at the farm. It managed itself. All it required was maintenance from the brothers and harvest and weeding here and there, but for the most part, they had to do less work. And everywhere you walked, there was just abundance, and it was very fecund, and everything was green and different colors. And that was a place where I sort of first heard about kale and Swiss chard. And I'd never, you know, I'd heard about those things before, but I was never really interested in them. Always thinking about other things, I guess, in my life, and other foods like pizza and burgers. Agriculture and farming was something that both was really interesting to me, but also something that was meaningful to me, something that I could get my hands around and do rather than just think about. When I started working on farms, I started eating off the farm, and my life changed quite a bit. I was an active person beforehand, but I just needed calories when I was in college, right? And so I ate pretty much anything. But I feel cleaner now. I feel like I have more energy. I used to have real sort of slow periods, down times during the day where I just got tired. I had fatigue issues. And what I found is that as I started eating more foods that were whole and unprocessed, that my body responded really well. When you eat food that was picked fresh and that hasn't been processed, hasn't been shipped for long distances, that was alive just moments ago, that I think that your body recognizes that.
When food is alive, it makes you feel alive. Now back to nutritionist Kelly Dorfman. I asked her about the safety of food colorings.
There were two independent studies that were done by the European Union around 2000. To answer the question, does food coloring cause kids to become hyperactive and cause issues? And these studies found that there was a small but significant subgroup of children who were they were affected by the food colors, like many parents have reported through the years. Not all of the children, and not enough to say, oh my goodness, nobody should have it, but enough of the children that they put a warning label that says this food might affect the behavior of your child. These food colorings come from oil, basically. They come from petroleum. They're petroleum-based. They're very stable. They're cheap. They're bright. They can glow in the dark and be very.
And they could make you glow in the dark.
They could make
you
possibly glow in the dark. So it's hard to beat a strawberry that looks redder than a real strawberries type thing. There is in the good news department, there is a growing industry for natural colors. They're growing purple carrots and all kinds of sweet potatoes. And parents are really demanding this, that they want more natural colors. Some of them, the color that's really sticking them is blue.
Really? Yes, there's not many blue foods out there.
That's the problem. That is the problem. And Skittles is even, the company that produces the candy Skittles, has been spending a lot of time and money looking for natural colors, and they are stuck on blue.
So blue is a challenge, but how can we, so perhaps stay away from the blues, but how can we know which ones are safe and which ones are not when we're actually looking at food colorings on our ingredients label?
I do think you want to avoid artificial colors of all types, period, because you have to detoxify them through the same pathways you detoxify drugs, which might be why some children in particular and even adults can get headaches or have other rashes from food colorings. So they're a very high allergy substance. In fact, if you go to get allergy medication, you'll notice that many of them have a dye-free version, and that's because the dyes themselves could cause allergies. And wouldn't it be silly to take an allergy medicine with dye in it and then react to the medicine?
And that's a good point, because if you're looking for hypoallergenic things, like even down to bathroom tissue, you're looking for things that are not dyed or that kind of thing. Right. So why would you put them in your food? Now, often we see flavoring on an ingredients list. And what could that flavoring be?
Anything. It could be absolutely anything, including MSG. A lot of times it's proprietary. It could be artificial. I have a colleague that I know who produces flavors, and he told me once that they can make anything taste like anything except for two flavors. One of them, it was marijuana, believe it or not, and we don't need that. But mostly they can make strawberries taste like chicken. I mean, they have the capacity alchemically to make anything taste like anything. So you have to watch that very carefully. And I think you want to stick to natural flavors. And again, you want to stick to ingredients you recognize.
Right. Now, natural flavors could mean sugar? Salt?
Well, sugar is...
Or what would natural flavors cover?
Natural flavors, well, it would be spices, for example. Sugar is a sweetener, and a preservative is, when you think about it, sugar is one of our first preservatives, wasn't it? But yes, you're right. Sugar would be a flavor. Cinnamon would be a flavor. Turmeric would be a flavor. There are all kinds of spices that you would use as natural flavors. And sometimes it'll just say natural flavor.
Now, foods today have a very unnatural shelf life. And you can, if you look at the Best Buy date, it can be months out for something that you would ordinarily, if you made it in your kitchen, might last a week. So do we need to worry about those food preservatives?
I do think you have to worry about some of them because some of them can be hormone disruptors. Some of them can be irritating and cause allergic reactions. And we don't, again, a lot of them aren't tested based on the first section we were talking about. We don't really know what the safety data is on some of them. There's just too many of them. The food companies are so big, and they have such resources, and they're putting so many interesting things on the market that we really can't keep up with them. So it's really to the consumer.
Mm. Now, another thing that people are worried about is the lining in canned goods, sort of what sits between the food and the metal of that can.
The BPA, sometimes called BPA, and then there's a relative of that called BPS. And these are hormone disruptors. They've been found to be a problem for children and for adults. We do have these residues in our blood. And by hormone disruptor, it means that it mimics your hormones, but it isn't your hormone. So it tells your body that there's a hormone activity without being the hormone. And of course, this can increase your cancer risk if you're a woman, because many cancers, especially female cancers, are hormone related. And these disruptors may be related to that.
So can you buy canned goods that are safe, that don't have hormone disruptors in them, don't have these plasticizers there, and how would you tell?
increasingly you're seeing no BPA on a label that will tell you that they're not using it. Very often, even at the top of cans is where you'll see more of it. And BPS, which is a relative and has the same properties basically of BPA, is found in those heat-treated receipts you get. You notice that they can print receipts all day and there's no ink? And those use BPA, this kind of plasticizer. So touching receipts is another way that people actually get a fair amount of exposure to BPS. So you can say no thank you to the receipt.
So a can might say no BPA, but
yes,
it could then have BPS.
BPS is mostly in these heat-treated receipts, but there are these related plastics in many different kinds of products. And increasingly, we're thinking that plastic, just in general, isn't working out so well in terms of safety.
Or in terms of pollution. Now, consider this. A label on a packet of food will tell us what we're eating, its nutritional value, and who made it. Some labels change the value of what's inside. For example, if the label reads non-GMO, we might be more willing to pay extra for it. If the label says cholesterol-free or trans-fat-free, we might be more keen to eat it. Did you know that in the spiritual realm there's a labeling process? The Bible talks a lot about the coming judgment, a day of reckoning. Not a topic we like to think about too much, but in the book of Revelation it talks about the end time and how every living person will be given a label. One label is called the seal of God, and it's worn on the forehead. Why there? Well, that's where we have our frontal lobe, the seat of our spirituality, morality, and the will, or our decision center. The other label is called the mark of the beast. It too is worn on the forehead, or it can be worn on the hand. That indicates ownership by the beast, by intentional disobedience to God, or by simply acting it out. These labels are not barcodes, the number 666, or anything visible to the human eye, but they are visible to the judge of all the earth. Those who receive his seal become of infinite value because Jesus paid an infinite price for them. He redeemed them in exchange for his own life. And their response: to love and serve him at any cost. At the end of time, will you be ready to follow the Lamb wherever he leads?
We're back, and you don't want to miss today's exercise segment. So get your Swiss ball or your exercise ball out, because Sean's here.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Good to see you. So as you can see, we have our stability ball. And the great way, number one, all stability balls are not created equal. Okay, so that's number one. So for sizing purposes, what you want to see is you want to be able to sit on your ball and you want your legs to be parallel to the ground. If your hips are lower than your knees, then your ball, then the stability ball is too low. Okay, or you need to pump it up a little bit more.
Right.
Okay, so I just wanted to put that out there. So these exercises that we're going to do today are a little bit more on the challenging side, but are focused towards this whole abdominal area. Okay, a lot of people ask questions, how do I get rid of this? Yeah, it's about what you eat, but it's about the exercises. And I want you to think about ways to challenge your core, right?
Yep.
So that you can kind of trim it down a little bit.
Right.
So we're going to warm up. Let's use the stability ball. Your arms are going to be out front. And all I want you to do is twist to the side. Keep your eyes forward and twist. Keep on going, and I'll explain something. So what you should feel are your obliques engage, right? Go to the point where you feel the abdominal area kind of stretching a little bit. You want that stretch. Because what we're gonna do today will involve those same exact muscles. And sometimes doing a warm-up that involves those muscles gets it prepared for the movement. Okay, so give me two more reps. One and two. I like that you're rotating your foot. That means you're getting a good range of motion. All right, so number one, what we're gonna do is have a seat and we're gonna roll. All right, actually, you can do it. I think you can do it totally fine. So what I want you to do is put your hands together, clasp them together. And I want you to keep your abdominal area tight. This is called a bridge, okay?
All right.
So keep that tight. You're working the core. The core is not just the front, but it's the side and the back. I want you to rotate to that side, just allowing your shoulder. There you go. Perfect. And back to the center. Get your center of your balance, and then go the other side. You could do maybe about 20 reps. You know, see how you feel. You will feel a challenge in your oblique area, okay? So keep rotating. Make sure you are breathing. Inhaling through your nose, exhaling through your mouth. Give me two more, one on each side. One more. Perfect. And from that position, stay right there. Keep there. Now, the reason why I like to keep someone on the Swiss ball is because if you're in this bridge position and I keep you in this tense position, your core is working the entire time. So what I want you to do is put your hand here, and I want you to just walk your feet back and do almost like a sit-up. All the way up, eyes forward. Yep, now walk it back into that bridge position. Yes, and back. All the way up, eyes forward, come back. Now this can be a challenging exercise, so when you're out there, I want you to take your time, all right? Three, two, one more, and up. There you go, that's not bad. All right, that's a bridge to almost like a sit-up. And then we're gonna finish off with a wood chop. Well, we're not chopping any wood, we're just gonna use the Swiss ball. So right here to the side, go to the side, and stretch. If you can see my feet, they rotate just to allow a good range of motion. And make sure you're breathing, okay? There's no need for you to go really hard on this, which you can do for maybe about 10 to 15 reps on each side. And it's a great way to sculpt and challenge your obliques. Everybody talked about love handles. This is how you give your love handles some love.
Yeah,
so there you go.
They won't be loving you back.
They won't be loving you back. So that's a wood chop, and I think that's a great exercise. You could use a kettlebell, you could use a dumbbell, but a great tool is a Swiss ball. It's very simple, but you can do a whole lot with the abdominal area.
Yeah.
Okay?
That's great.
And most importantly, what I would like you to do to stretch out, just kind of go here. The abdominal area may be tight. That's fine. And you're all good. That's it.
That's great. Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome.
Didn't get a workout, though.
I did.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I pushed you.
We let him off.
Colorectal cancer, a leading cause of death in the U.S., usually begins with the growth of benign polyps. The good news is that polyps can be avoided with a high-fiber diet. The Adventist Health Study found that eating legumes at least three times a week, or brown rice once a week, reduced the risk of colon polyps by about 40%. Whole grains and legumes, such as garbanzos, beans, and lentils, are an excellent source of fiber. A high-fiber diet is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time for me to answer your questions. Here's our first one. John asks, I have a high number for a PSA reading. Are there any foods that I could eat that might lower my number? Well, as long as it's not cancer, you need to eat a good, healthy diet. Dr. Dean Ornish has a good program that's been proven to work for this problem, and essentially, it's a low-fat, whole-food, plant-based diet with fitness, stress management, love, and support. That's his sort of four-pronged attack. You can check that out at ornish.com, where you'll find the same program helps the heart and the prostate. So that's ornish.com. So don't be put off when you see all the heart stuff. It's exactly the same program. Next question is, someone texted, I thought radiation destroyed the food, so I was surprised that you recommended microwave cooking in your demos. Well, Dr. Greger did the research, and he found that microwave cooking is less destructive to food, and it's not radiation. Microwave uses waves of energy that are a little bit shorter than radio waves, so it's like your radio. You don't get radiation from your radio. Similar waves to that, and those waves selectively cause what's called asymmetrically charged water molecules to vibrate very quickly, and that's what causes the heat. Microwave cooking shortens cooking time, don't need very much water, and therefore fewer nutrients are lost when you're cooking with a microwave oven than with other methods of cooking. And microwaves have been around now for several decades, and as far as we can tell, they're safe. They've been around long enough that we should have seen some effect. Dry cooking, like roasting, frying, barbecuing, all increase acrylamides, which are carcinogenic, and boiling in water leaches out nutrients in the water, which is often discarded, and you lose those nutrients. So those are two cooking methods that I don't recommend. Someone called and said, I've been diagnosed with schizophrenia. I would like to know what I can do to reduce hallucinations. This is a very serious condition. And hallucinations can cause you to behave in a manner that is dangerous sometimes. So you require sort of strict adherence to your medications that are prescribed by a psychiatrist. There is a significant advantage to eating a healthy diet, staying fit and strong, and having a healthy lifestyle that enhances brain function, but you do need to be under the care of a psychiatrist. Well, remember, you can send your questions to us by all these different ways. Contact us on our website and leave a question there. Like us on Facebook and become part of our Go Healthy for Good community. Now it's time to go shopping. Eggplant is known as aubergine, brinjal, and even guinea squash. It belongs to the nightshade family, and so it's related to the tomato, the potato, peppers, and capsicum. It was domesticated in India, where it's made into the most delicious curries. In Italy, there's the famous eggplant parmesan. In France, there's ratatouille. In Turkey and Greece, there's moussaka. And in the Middle East, it's roasted and made into baba ganoush. It's got to be one of my favorite vegetables. I even put it on my homemade pizza. However, it's high in histamines, so some people have an allergy to eggplant and actually to all the nightshade vegetables. I've seen arthritis improve by eliminating all the nightshade foods from the diet. But if you don't have an allergy, then bon appetit. We're talking today about labelling of food and food safety. In the last segment, we were talking about the dangers of plastics in general and BPA in particular. I asked today's guest, Kelly Dorfman, if the plastic in water bottles continue to pose a risk.
They're getting better, but have you noticed that water now has an expiration date? Sometimes when you buy a case of water, you'll see that it says use by. That's because of the preservatives in the containers that hold. Obviously, water doesn't expire,
right.
But the bottles can expire because of preservatives that are in the plastic, that are built into the plastic.
And are some plastics better than others?
We know that BPA, which we were just talking about, is higher in when they have the recycling code in the bottom, the triangle, if it says 7. And those are the harder plastics. Usually these kind of bottles are 1s or 2s. But on the good news front, you can buy these really cute glass bottles that have a rubber surrounding. So if you drop it on the floor or your child throws it across the room, it won't break. And that is probably the safest thing to do. And it's cheaper, too.
Yes, it is. That's right. Now, we put lotions, creams, shampoo on our skin all the time, every day. Soaps. Do we need to worry about what's inside of them and what particular things should we be looking for?
I think you do have to watch that because you're really eating through your skin when you think about it. Because think of all the medicines they now have that you absorb through your skin. So you're absorbing a lot of these chemicals through your skin too. And there are a lot of consumer groups now that are looking at safe cosmetics. And you can go online and you can look up some of your favorite products and look at the ingredients because unlike food, the cosmetic industry is the Wild West. There's literally no regulations. You can put carcinogens, you can put lead, you can put mercury, although most of them have taken mercury out because people don't like it. But you can put practically anything in a cosmetic. The Europeans have much stronger laws about it. So that really is up to you, the consumer, to watch out for.
So maybe buy European cosmetics or mineral-based cosmetics.
You have to go to Europe to buy them because when they ship them here, they actually ship them because the rules are different.
Oh.
So take that Paris vacation you always wanted.
Oh, okay, thank you. I will. Now, does everything that's in food appear on the label? If we read the ingredients list regularly when we're buying products, are we going to know exactly what is in that product?
No, you can't always know because we just mentioned how water bottles have preservatives in the bottle. There's also preservatives that can be in the lining, for example, of a cereal. Wrapping and the way that it's packaged. So you can look at that. There are some parts during processing where you won't see the ingredients. And for example, if you go to the store and you buy an apple, you think that the ingredient is just apple,
well, yes.
But that likely has a wax on it. And that wax can have sodium lauryl sulfate in it, which is an ingredient that's found in shampoo. That can have insect parts in it. It can have wheat in it. It could have corn in it. It could have petroleum products in it. Or all of them. And there's absolutely no way to know that. And that's about as healthy and as basic as you can get.
Well, it is. That's yes. Right. Because I always say, well, go to the produce section and you know what you're getting.
That's
but,
right.
But if it's waxed, perhaps you don't.
You're getting fruit plus wax.
What if you buy an organic apple? Does that make a difference?
It does make a difference, but some of them use wax. It's not that wax is bad for you, because wax does keep the moisture from coming out of the fruit, and it allows us to have a nice crispy apple this time of year. Now, let's face it, apples are harvested in the fall, and if you didn't put something on them, they're pretty mushy right now. And so it can be good, but there's no way to know what's in the wax they're using. So you're hoping that a product that is going to the trouble to be organic either doesn't have wax on it or has a wax on it that's inert.
Mm. Now, are there any organizations that can help us with finding, resources that would help us to find the better options of our foods?
I think that this is one way that the internet can be, of course, good and bad, because you almost have to look up the subject you want, because there's so much. Like, wax in itself is just one subject, and that's probably not covered under general food safety. Or there's Moms Across America, and they're doing a lot of looking at glyphosate in children's cereals and children's food. So I think you would ask that question, the one that you're concerned about, and then you would start there.
Now, if you're looking at the ingredients list on your food label, and you get down to the bottom, and there are some things that you're not familiar with, say lecithin or carrageenan, what tell us about those kinds of common but fine print stuff.
Yeah, I think that that's when it's a good time to look those up and see what they really are, because those are common ingredients that are mostly safe. Now, some people do have trouble with carrageenan. People with irritable bowel syndrome occasionally have complaints that carrageenan does not agree with them. But lecithin, which is a soy derivative, is usually safe unless you have some sort of soy anaphylactic allergy, which you're in big trouble if you have that, since soy is in practically everything. Lecithin is an emulsifier, and it is a safe food additive. It allows you to put water and oil together. Think of things you need to do that with. Salad dressing, for example, where you want to mix these two things. So that's why it's so common, because it's taking the oils in the food and the water-soluble ingredients and helping them to integrate. So in general, that's a fairly safe ingredient.
Right, because you see that in breads and all kinds of things, don't you?
Yeah, it's not like every ingredient's bad.
We need to work out which are bad and avoid them. Otherwise, we'll become afraid of our own shadows. Willowsford Farm grows more than 100 varieties of veggies, herbs, fruit and flowers, along with livestock. It's located in Northern Virginia, just 35 miles from downtown Washington, D.C. Mike Snow is the Director of Farm Operations at Willowsford. Here he shares why the farm exists.
As the developers created the plan for the community, they clustered the housing and then left these big open spaces nearby. And so the question was, well, how do we manage all of that open space? And the farm is the answer to part of that. So we manage about 300 acres of a couple thousand acres of open space. We farm in a way that we think is healthy for people, not just in terms of eating fresh foods, but also eating food that is clean and they can feel good about. We sell to the public, and we do all of this on site through a couple of farm stands and through a subscription program called CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture. The community seems to be glad that we're here. I think that we provide good food and also a good welcoming place for people to come and meet each other and spend time with each other. And especially they bring their kids and they expose their kids to what real food is, and they get to get their hands dirty and feel like, oh, I can pick this raspberry and I don't have to worry about washing it, or I don't have to think about pesticide residue, things like that. We want the farm to be in everybody's kitchen. Part of that is just buying fruits and vegetables. But a lot of that is also learning how to cook and feeling confident in the kitchen and knowing what to do with seasonal produce. It's hard, you know, if you want to make pesto in the winter, we may not have basil. You know, we don't grow basil in the winter. But we do try to empower people to learn about how to make pesto with other herbs. We hope that this can be a model for how we develop land that both satisfies our needs for housing and communities and neighborhoods, but also that provides functioning ecosystems, riparian areas that actually can help clean water and keep water clean at least, and then also provide agricultural benefits. So we can take care of land that can produce food for the people who are living here. And in each of these things, we can have a healthy neighborhood, have a healthy ecosystem, and have a healthy farm. If we can show that this works, that it's a benefit to the people, and that the farm can survive on its own off of its sales, that maybe we'd see more of this in the future.
More would be great, so I hope it's successful. Now back to our discussion on food labeling. There are reports of limited accuracy on labeling when buying fish. I asked Kelly to explain the reason for this.
It's difficult to be very sure about that. It's harder with mixed products or if you're doing a fish stick or something. If you go to the fish market and you know a little bit about the fish, you can sometimes tell. And there's less of a chance of you having a problem if you're buying the fish fresh. But once it's processed into a stick or into some kind of other product, there's a much higher chance. And up to 80%, for example, of sushi tuna, they said, has been mislabeled to some extent. And some of this is just by accident because, like you said, when you're coming down the chute and you're sorting as fast as you can, there's going to be a couple of pike that go in with the marlins or whatever. But so we know that it's not all purposeful. But food fraud is actually a pretty big business. In olive oil, for example, they found that coming into the country, imported olive oil, 60 to 70% of it can have adulterated other oils besides olive oil in it.
So what's the advantage of doing that? Is it because the other oils are cheaper or?
Yes, and also they've had a bad olive crop, some years, and so that can also stretch it out. Interestingly, a University of California study found that probably California and Australian olive oil has been the least adulterated with other kinds of oils. But it's all really about money. I saw a picture online of some people in Italy. Policemen actually in suits dragging off somebody who had been adulterating olive oil because they take their olive oil very seriously over there. So, and we import a lot of olive oil from Italy.
Well, that's right. I was just going to say we import the olive oil from Italy, but you're saying that a lot of that is...
Yeah, it has other things in it. It's really not much of a concern in terms of health safety. They're not putting poisonous oils as far as anybody can see. But I did notice in my practice that sometimes children were reacting to olive oil, which is really unusual. But if they cut it with hazelnut oil and they have nut allergies, that can be a real problem. And that's more of my concern. So if you have a child with nut allergies, you better watch your olive oil and perhaps stick with California.
Okay, that's good advice. Yeah. Now, we're talking about the safety, all these safety issues around food. Give us some resources. Are there good, you're saying go to the web, but you know, there are websites and then there are credible websites.
That's
and
true.
There are a lot more of the uninformed guesswork websites than there are that are credible and reliable and valid. So do you have any particular websites that you favor when you're searching for things like this?
Well, there's a for-profit organization called Consumer Lab that tests supplements, for example, and they make sure that you have to join them, but they make sure that the supplements have in them what's on the label, which is a very useful thing to know. And, for example, they looked at probiotics to make sure the potency was matching.
And they're called, sorry?
Consumer Lab.
Consumer Lab. So that would be for supplements. What about for foods?
Well, for foods, it's a little bit tricky. Like I said, it's almost like you have to go from food to food to look at it. A Center for Science and the Public Interest has done some advocacy work that's been very good.
EWG,
yeah, Environmental Working Group. That's probably my favorite group. They do a lot of fish because fish also has problems with mercury. And so they have a list of high, low, and medium fish, and that's EWG.org.
And if you know what your fish is, that's fine and well and good, but if you don't...
Assuming it's the fish you think it is.
Assuming
that's what
that
you paid for.
Yeah.
So I think that's a very... And they also have a cosmetic section, a safe cosmetic section that I use frequently.
I do too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I like them. Anyone else that you...
Oh, those are probably my first ones, but that because they've been consistently doing this for a very long time, and they are doing advocacy work for this. I mean, a lot of the other splinter groups, like you're saying, they're doing a little of this here, a little of that there, but you can easily find your own things. But I think the most important thing is you get educated about what's in your food and really get label savvy. Pick up those, spend an extra few minutes when you're shopping until you get used to the labels and really get savvy about what's in the food that you're buying mostly.
Now, is there a reliable way to get safe food on our plates, to know what we're eating and to be sure it's healthy? Because, you know, we talked about the waxed apple, but there's so much other stuff in the produce aisle, isn't there, that we could safely eat or...
Well, I think that this is a real call to know your farmers. We became friends with some Amish farmers, my husband and myself, and we felt very confident that they were raising the most pure and honest food. So I think getting to know your local farmers, joining a CSA can be very useful. You can join an organic one, as Dr. Seneff had mentioned in another section of this
show. What's CSA,
Community Sustained Agriculture. You can basically support a farm, and you pay them in advance, usually at the end of the winter, so they have a budget they can work with. And then every week you get a small amount of food from that farm. And that's another way that you can support and also get to know more what's going on with your food supply. We are so many steps away. The problem is the many steps. And what always is shocking to me is things I find out. I didn't even think to know. Like, I didn't even think to know about wax. It just came up at some point, but who would know? Who would think about it? And that's part of the problem when you're looking if you don't know what you don't know. So I think the closer you can get to your food supply, growing some vegetables for yourself perhaps, that I think is the most healthy.
Right, because if we grow it ourselves, we get the exercise, the sunshine, the good food, and we can do it organically.
And the gratification of a job well done, right?
So there are all those spin-offs that can really pay back. And if you have a young family, you can teach your children how to grow, and you're actually handing on that skill and that knowledge as well.
And they can see that a vegetable really isn't from a plant, and it's not just a packaged square that
right.
all looks
and,
the
and
same.
And I think when children grow their own food, it's been found that they're much more likely to eat it, is that?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Well, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Become educated about how food safety is regulated and monitored in your area so that you can make the best choices for you and your family. You might be interested in keeping an eye on watchdog websites like Centre for Science in the Public Interest, Environmental Working Group, and the Centre for Food Safety so that you can stay informed. Remember, not all ingredients will appear on the label. Buy organic if you can. Wash your foods really well. Make the necessary changes to reduce your and your family's exposure to chemicals as much as possible. Think of pesticides, cookware, plastics, cosmetics, and even water. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.